Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Okay, campers, rise and shine, and don't forget your booties, because it's cold out there today. Winter is coming, Don. Winter is coming.
It sounded like Groundhog Day.
Never heard of it. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. How you doing today there, Donnie? We're continuing to ride the tide with Casey's classic countdowns.
Yeah, we're going to keep on riding them. No, we are going to stop this soon, right? Is this it? A hiatus?
Let's call it a pause. Who knows?
A break. You
know? Yeah. We were on a break!
But yeah, I definitely want to revisit it in the future.
Yeah, I mean, Casey Kasem and countdowns and top tens, it's been a challenging and fun experience.
Next time we should do Rick D's.
I think it would be pretty much the same charts with a less interesting personality. No offense, Rick. So, this is, of course, the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums in the album format, and we like talking about them. What more can I say?
We do like it.
We've got a great show for you today. We'll be concluding our Casey's Classic Countdown series.
Some good alliteration there. Yeah,
it's challenging. With two hand-picked albums, one from each of us, that will be from artists that had top 10 singles on the charts December 2nd, 1989. Then, of course, Don will be asking us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging. And then we will reveal what kind of albums we'll be exploring next time. But this week, it's all about Casey, and it's all about 1989.
That's what I'm talking about!
For our new episode of Classics, actually, I'll say concluding. For our concluding episode of Classic Casey Countdowns, we jump to December 2nd, 1989, tracing the stories behind two albums connected to top 10 hits from Casey Kasem's chart. Continuing our tribute to Casey and his American top 40 legacy, we each spotlight a record tied to a charting hit, reflecting on how his countdowns captured the pop spirit at the close of the decade.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so we're headed for the 90s, living in the wild, wild west of 1989 here. Let's get into the other considerations real quick. At number 10, we'll be talking about that later. Number 9, When I See You Smile by Bad English from an album of the same name.
Yeah. John Waite and Jonathan Cain and Neil Schon.
Yeah. So Journey and some other dudes.
Yeah. From the Babies.
Yeah.
The Bebes.
I don't know much, but I know I love you. Linda Ronstadt and Aaron Neville from Linda's album Cry Like a Rainstorm. Howl Like the Wind. Look at this face. Yeah, okay, I'm done. Back to Life by Soul to Soul from the album Club Classics, Volume 1. Really? That's
what, because they were like a collective, and okay. So each album is like some compilation like that.
I got to be honest, I didn't even Back take a swing life. At that one. Another Day in Paradise by Phil Collins from his album But Seriously.
Sounds like a stand-up comedian. But seriously, folks. Yeah,
exactly. This would have been great, but we talked about this album this past summer. Love Shack by the B-52s from Cosmic Thing, mm-hmm. which we really both... I learned to love, and Don had already.
You shook your honey buns.
I certainly did. And number 4 was Angelia by Richard Marx from his album Repeat Offender. I don't remember that song.
Wherever you go.
I think that's Angelia.
No, but that's on that album.
Okay, so. Well. And number 3 we'll be covering on the program. And number 2, We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel from Stormfront.
Harry Truman, Doris Day.
Yeah. I didn't like that song then, and I still, meh. But the album itself has some good songs, but it just didn't land for me. And then at number 1 was pretty much just like impossible because the album isn't even available that it's from. Blame It on the Rain by Milli Vanilli from the album Girl, You Know It's True. And that doesn't seem to be available in that form.
Right. Yeah, we would have had to do some cutting and pasting, I think, of tracks.
And I don't know if it would have been a fruitful discussion. All right. So the picks are in. The 90s are coming. We're holding Casey Kasem's hand, getting to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
So the number three song in the nation on December 2nd, 1989 came from an artist named Paula Abdul, born Paula Julie Abdul, June 19th in 1962.
So exotic. Yeah. I love it when they change their performing name.
This is her debut album called Forever Your Girl. She actually started out in the dance realm. She was a Los Angeles Lakers cheerleader, quickly became sort of the head of the squad and the head choreographer for the Laker girls. Then the Jacksons discovered her. She ended up choreographing one of the Jacksons' videos. Then she ended up doing Janet, Prince, George Michael, Duran Duran, ZZ Top, all sorts of stuff.
ZZ Top is like, does it, it's like, what?
Right.
Did she, you know, maybe the thing when they do with their
yes, that's what
arms,
I was
saying. You know, the. That was her.
So apparently Janet Jackson heard her singing, I think, you know, when they were choreographing something, and she suggested that Paula Abdul should have a music career. So why not? She got a record deal, and here's her debut album, and here's the song that was number three that week. It's Just the Way That You Love Me.
Janet Jackson vibe is all over this record.
What have you done for me lately?
Mm-hmm.
I remember this song, but it's not even, you know, one of the first hits I think of from Paula Abdul, because there's a bunch of them. So this song was written by Oliver Lieber, who's son of legendary songwriter Jerry Lieber.
Who wrote what?
He wrote a bunch of Elvis songs, you know, like Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So you have a bunch of these industry songwriters and producers involved in this album. There's a whole team of them, which makes sense because, you know, I don't think Paula Abdul had music industry experience beyond the dance realm. So professionals writing songs for her. This one definitely has a New Jack Swing vibe, you know, as you mm-hmm. suggested, yeah. Very much like, you know, a Janet Jackson record.
A little less edgy, I would say.
Yeah, I think so.
It's supposed to be a little more accessible. I mean, not that New Jack Swing wasn't accessible, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I would say the arrangements are maybe a little simpler.
Just sounds more friendly, if that makes any sense.
Yes, I would agree with that. So the lyrics organize images of wealth and power, then dismiss them as unimportant compared to how he loves her. Right. So that's
right.
Yeah, kind of an old... I've heard that in other songs before. We'll see how she does when he files for bankruptcy.
She'll stand by her man. Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's bright, aerobic even, yeah. Synth polished and built on drum machine grooves. I mean, it showcases Paula's breathy, rhythmic singing style. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of the, it's sort of, again, the Janet Jackson effect. She was kind of breathy, but I think it was, in this case, maybe more of a being new to singing as a performer, probably the easier, you know, not mm-hmm. pushing it too much yeah. vocally.
But she does sound a little more mature than, you know, Janet always kind of has the baby voice.
Yeah.
And so she sounds not completely grown up, but maybe 10 years older or so.
But like in the American Top 40 era, this sounded right at home, like next to Taylor Dane, Janet.
Yeah.
Expose, like it fit right in.
So this album was released in June of 1988. And so now in December of 89, we're on like the fifth single now, I think the fourth or fifth single. So, I mean, they just kept coming. But the one that broke through first was this one, Straight Up. So that is a catchy little ditty, as they say.
Do you love me? Do you love me?
That's a good one.
Yeah, it has stuck in my brain for a long, long, long time.
Yeah. So you know, obviously, just a hit record. You know, right? You recognize that from the first time you hear it. Written by Elliot Wolf, who also played synthesizers and handled drum programming. So my impression here, it was actually it was a pretty cheap record to produce. I think the whole thing I read was like $72,000 or something that
wow.
from like Paula's savings from all the choreography.
Was she paid for this?
Yeah, or she had to, you know, she was kind of in charge, I think, of collecting all the money wow. to do it. But so I don't think there's a lot of live instrumentation on the album. Most of it is you know, drum tracks and synthesizers, but does feature guitar from session guitarist Dan Huff. New Jack Swing, but God, just so
energetic. Yes. Energetic New Jack Swing.
Yep. Yeah. I could do aerobics to this.
Yeah, sure.
With my headband and leg warmers.
That's all anyone thinks about. Like, can I or can't I do aerobics to this? I think the simplicity of it is its strength. You know, the space in that mix leaves room for the attitude and that sort of sharp phrasing.
Yeah.
Sam Mentor. You know, it's, there's a lot of very crisp phrasing there. And I think it adds to the attitude of tell me what's going on here.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, certainly one of the defining singles of 89 and captures that late 80s pop, shifting toward New Jack and harder rhythmic edges, but, you know, playing it a little safer.
Yeah. And certainly this album isn't providing challenging lyrics, but a song like this, you know, it's kind of a universal idea, you know, the uncertainty of romance, wondering, you know, where you stand with the other person.
Well, and they captured that same sort of nasty boys attitude of Janet Jackson, where it's like, you know, she's a demure lady, but when it's like time to stand up for herself, it's like, you're going to answer my damn questions.
Yeah.
And I think that was a really important part of female artists and pop music at this time, particularly when it's like they're dancing around for everyone's pleasure. They got to, you know, maybe the Madonna effect. They got to be like, I'm a strong woman too.
Yes. Miss Abdul, if you're nasty.
Exactly.
Well, was there a track you wanted to highlight?
I didn't have the album or anything, but the single that I guess was a guilty pleasure was Cold Hearted. That one was released in June of 89, written and produced by Elliot Wolff. That one, I believe, was number one on Billboard Hot 100 at some point. Again, New Jack Swing, dance pop, tougher, funkier side, certainly inspired by Janet Jackson's Control, I would say, but with a poppier sheen. The video had that chair choreography, which was very reminiscent of, you know, old-timey musicals, Singing in the Rain and junk like that, when they would dance with chairs and mops and whatever.
This one was steamy.
Yes. The syncopation and synth brass stabs are very classic late 80s dance pop. But again, a confident performance, sort of a warning and an admission of infatuation. You know, he's a cold-hearted snake. And I love that S in there. Avoid this guy, but, you know, the bad boy thing, you know?
Yeah, my favorite part of the song, actually, I think there's like a little break where it's just the orchestral part, which is synth-driven. Mm-hmm. Reminds me of New Order.
Oh, God. You got to find a way to get synth pop in there.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I mean, just another great pop song. And again, you know, kind of a universal thing, you know, in the world of romance, right? The idea of somebody being dangerous or, you know, somebody that's going to burn you or bite you.
All that whole, like, Halloween trick-or-treating thing that works its way in there is interesting as well.
The world's a candy store. He's been trick-or-treating.
Yeah. I mean, some off-the-wall ways of expressing these things, maybe in ways that young people can connect with, like, hey, I've been trick-or-treating. I understand.
But like you said, the phrasing, you know, she's really good at.
Yes, maybe it's the dancer where you've got to hit your marks.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, she's definitely like banging when she's supposed to. And I think it's probably some of that rhythmic being a dancer, that training and that aesthetic in her brain. So that
makes sense.
Interestingly, worked out very well.
All right, and so we arrive at the final cut of the album. This is One or the Other.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's Paula. There's no way that other lady is better.
Unless she wants you to choose between her and Janet.
Oh, that's rude.
So, yeah, kind of. It's another dance record, maybe a little slower than you know, some of the others, you know. But, yeah, I, you know, it kind of typical of the sound of the album. And, you know, I think it's fitting that it ends in this way. I actually saw it described as like a mid-tempo ballad. I don't really, I wouldn't say that.
Yeah. I mean, it gives you enough room at the school dance to do the running man, right? So you still got the rhythm there, but there's enough space. It's not moving so frenetically.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, another, again, you know, since you said that, you know, the phrasing of her voice, the way the words match up with the rhythm is really, you know, well executed.
Yeah. I obviously I wasn't there, but it feels like that part just came naturally.
Yeah. That's such an underrated part of singing, I think.
Mm-hmm. But as a closer, it does give the album a upbeat finale.
Mm-hmm.
And, it fades out, right? It's one of those, yeah. It's got the fade outs. Yeah. I think that's effective. I think artists are using that again mm-hmm. now. There was a period where the fade out kind of died in the grunge era and stuff, but I appreciate a good fade out.
Yeah, sure. All right. Good time to rewind and reflect on Forever Your Girl. Start with my clickbait headline. Forever Your Girl is straight up dance pop, leaving you warm-hearted. As opposed to cold-hearted.
You worked on that for a while, yeah, didn't you? You're workshopping that with your wife, waking her up in the middle of the night. I think I got it.
Yeah, I mean, like, we've been doing a lot of these records lately, you know, that are just meant to be pop, right? I mean, they're just...
like Wham and...
Yeah, they're meant to just please the listener and not challenge the listener. And, you know, so for that purpose, it's perfect. Yeah. But it's so it's synth driven dance pop, you know, with elements of R&B. You've got, you know, bright hooks. You know, she's not a masterful singer or anything, but she has, you know, as we said, you know, she's great, you know, with the rhythmic lines. She's assertive. You know, she has
confidence.
Yeah, confidence. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So she's an empowered protagonist in these songs, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I didn't really understand that when I was a kid, and this was, they were just like pop songs that were cute or whatever. But yeah, there's definitely more to it underneath the surface when you dig in a little bit. My clickbait headline to describe the album, now that I read it, is really no more clever than Don's. Late 80s funk and new jack swing meet early 90s pop perfection in the album that made Paula Abdul everyone's girl.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're neck and neck on that. So this album is like the perfect late 80s pop distillation. Shiny, hyper-rhythmic, and catchy. Mixing that new jack swing percussion with Paula's relatable, charismatic vocals works very well. And definitely alongside Janet Jackson, Bobby Brown, Milli Vanilli, the album fits the era's sound, but also it sounds of its time, but it's not annoyingly so.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still enjoyable in terms of like what Don was saying, where it's there to please the listener. That still exists.
All right, well, killer to filler. You know, should mention, you know, another famous cut from the album, Opposites Attract.
Yes.
If you've seen the video, it's basically a duet, you know, with a cartoon kitty cat, MC Scat Cat.
Yeah.
Two steps forward.
I take two steps back.
We come together.
Because I'm dressed like a cat.
So Peter Griffin was not the original MC Scat Cat?
Okay. No. So MC Scat Cat was a fictional character, and it's actually, I didn't know this, but it's two guys' voices, a duo known as the Wild Pair. So it's
great name.
Yeah, they're wild.
The Wonder Twins.
It's Bruce DeShazer and Marv Gunn.
And you can hear those voices being used throughout the album and backing vocals and stuff, too.
Yes. Yep. They're all over the album. But that's, you know, it's a fun, catchy tune. The title track is...
Yeah, Forever Your Girl. Yeah. I like that song.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fine.
It's sugary, but, you know, when placed next to Straight Up and Cold Hearted. But, you know, it's sort of like an introduction, and it's like it's flirtatious a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And there's not a ton of that on here, and it's kind of a nice change.
Mm-hmm. Then there's another song about attraction. There's State of Attraction, which I think follows Opposites Attract, which I wonder if that was intentional. But that song's, I don't know. I guess I might put that on the filler list.
Yeah, I Need You
Yeah.
Was kind of on that list for me. It's again, there's nothing like, it's just like flush it type garbage on here. They're pop songs and some of them are better than others or more compelling.
Yeah. Next to You was the more like ballady one.
Yeah. And Knocked Out. And I had never heard the song Knocked Out until listening to this album over the last week. And they're all very close. These were just slightly weaker songs that are a little more forgettable, perhaps.
So it's interesting. So Knocked Out was the first single, then The Way That You Love Me, then Straight Up, then Forever Your Girl, then Cold Hearted, then Opposites Attract. And so then they must have brought back The Way That You Love
Me. It just goes to show like how these, in this era, these albums, they're built on singles. So you get the right single to really crack, and then you can recycle the things that maybe got released before or whatever. And, or then, you know, you sell the records and people are like, oh, I know this song. I know this song. I know this song. And it makes them want to listen to the whole thing more and more.
That was back in the era when they would save the strongest single for second or third.
Yeah.
Cause they really wanted, I think it started with like Born in the USA or, you know, around that era where you're just going to milk an album for 2 years worth of singles.
Yeah. Or Thriller. I mean, there's five years between that and its follow up. And I mean, they milked the hell out of it. They had like 9 singles off that album or something. So,
all right. Production, as I said, I think the total cost of production was $72,000. Somehow they managed to pay, you know, people like Babyface, you know, because Babyface was involved in the production, Oliver Lieber, Elliot Wolf, L.A. Reid. So a big team, but I think they saved money on instrumentation because I, other than the vocals and Dan Huff, the guitarist, I think everything else was done, you know, electronically, you know, drums and keyboards, and that's all you needed.
Yeah.
But it's stereotypical late 80s, early 90s production, focusing on dance beats, not a ton of low end yet.
Right.
And the vocals are, you know, kind of in the center.
Yeah. They're bright. I think they're doubled. I think that adds a little bit to the thickness. But it's clean and it's perfectly mixed for clarity and that kind of choreography driven feel. And then I'm sure that they had videos in mind as well when they were crafting these songs. So, yeah, sounds good.
And replay value. It's something I'll revisit for fun, you know.
Yeah. Or a light snack now and again.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, blast that in your car. Pull up at a gas station while you're singing Cold Hearted to whoever's next to you.
And so Legacy, I mean, it's definitely of its time. But, you know, I think it continued that legacy of the, you know, female star who's dancing is also, you know, kind of a, you know.
But she's dancing for her, not for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. And same model, which I think went on to, you know, some of the Britneys and Christinas that came later.
Yeah. In 89, Paula was everywhere. I mean, the album was a cultural event.
It was actually the first debut album by a female artist to produce 4 number one hit singles.
See, there you go. But she did help cement dance-driven pop as the dominant form of top 40 music. Kind of set the template for dancer pop stars, you know, J-Lo, even Britney and stuff like you were talking about. Forever Your Girl stands as one of the essential late 80s pop albums. It's bright, it's joyful, it's rhythmic and unmistakably of its time, but in the best way.
You know who's a fan of this record? Robert Smith from The Cure.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, does he cover any of these songs?
No, but he should.
Cold Hearted, he could. Oh, yeah. I think The Cure could do.
I'll try that later. All right. So, Paula Abdul's Forever Your Girl proves that the right hooks and infectious spirit can make a dance pop album feel fresh decades later. Check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So we've been kind of talking about our own personal life charts during these KC Classic Countdowns. What was on the top of your charts in December 1989?
I can't say specifically for December of 1989, because by that point, if you're talking about the things you wanted, say, for Christmas, you know, I always just wanted a TV for my room.
Oh, did you ever get it?
Not till I turned 18.
Wow. So you didn't have the Christmas Story thing where, like, you know, or the dad gets you the TV even though the mom didn't want you to have
no.
it?
No. No. Solidarity, baby. Yeah. But, you know, the thing, when you say 1989 and I think of my youth, Batman 1989.
Oh, yeah.
Now you want to get nuts? Come on. Let's get nuts.
Let's get nuts. I mean, Batman stuff, t-shirts, symbols, like oh, yeah. it was everywhere.
Yep.
And the I'm Batman it started there.
Yep.
I mean, it gets gruffer later on, but saying I'm Batman, I believe, started in 1989.
Yep.
How about you, Donald?
Well, 1989 is when I joined the, I think at the time they may have still called it the Columbia Record Club, mm-hmm. or maybe, I'm not sure when they did the rebranding.
Records to, and tapes.
To Columbia House.
Right.
You know, so it used to be the deal, like for one penny or something, you could choose like 12 cassettes.
Yeah, but I mean, but you were like a kid.
Yeah, but my parents, I think after, you know, many months of begging, you know, they finally let me do it. So I was trying to think of what albums I chose for that initial thing. And I remembered some of them. Some of them were pretty good. You know, like I got The Cure Disintegration, I remember. Depeche Mode 101, which was the live album. The Grateful Dead, The Skeletons in the Closet, the best of I got. Fine Young Cannibals, The Raw and the Cooked. Okay.
She drives me crazy.
Oh, shoot. What was the other? There was one that was embarrassing.
Fine Young Cannibals is up there.
Oh, Appetite for Destruction.
That's not embarrassing.
No, yeah, that, it wasn't. But that's another one. But it was embarrassing for me at the time because I was starting to be like cool new wave guy or alternative guy. And I, you know,
yeah, but that's one of those things where it's like, well, yeah, the lamest one of all these cool classic albums I picked. Well, meanwhile, I'm listening to Color Me Bad. You're just trying to outswag me.
Did you ever join Columbia House?
Yeah. Yeah, a few times. But I wasn't allowed to do it till I was like in high school.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's spoiled. Here I am, spoiled again.
I know.
All right. What was at the top of your chart in 1989? Let us know on the social media like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
Now, on with the countdown.
Number 10.
So, at number 10.
Casey's Coast to Coast.
Casey's Top 40, December 2nd, 1989, was Alice Cooper of 70s rock and roll fame with the single Poison. Alice Cooper began as a band formed in 1968 with Vincent Furnier and Glenn Buxton, Michael Bruce, Dennis Dunaway, and Neil Smith. Their style was hard rock, glam rock, theatrical shock rock, using guillotines and fake blood on their stage shows. But then Alice Cooper became the character, the man, Vincent Furnier. He adopted the stage name and launched a successful solo career starting in 1975 with Welcome to My Nightmare, continued with horror-themed shock rock persona throughout. But then in 1989, he released the album Trash, kind of a comeback, glam metal reinvention to put him back on the top 10 for the first time in a decade, his 11th solo album. The magic ingredient was producer, writer Desmond Child, the architect behind Bon Jovi, Aerosmith, the entire late 80s melodic hard rock sound. And Child co-wrote all but one track and shaped the album's entire identity, sharp hooks, glossy production, huge radio-friendly choruses, and we had guests on the album from Aerosmith, Bon Jovi, Winger, Toto. The result is a tight, punchy 10-track, 40-minute glam metal masterpiece. I had never listened to it before. I'll just say now, I grew to love it very quickly. Why don't we listen to a little bit of that top 10 hit, Poison. I like the line "venomous poison." Yeah. All the snake references, because Nicky used to wear a snake around his neck and crazy stuff like that.
I think around this time, because he was making that comeback, he was at some wrestling event. He was in Jake the Snake's corner.
Yeah, Jake the Snake was a python that he wore around his neck before his matches. Jake the Snake Roberts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so at the time, I thought this song was just like, you know, Winger or Warrant or something. I really, I enjoyed the occasional heavy metal or glam metal power ballad now and again, but I wasn't really a follower of the genre. I had no idea Alice Cooper was still around at that time. But and this song uses poison as a metaphor for a fatal, dangerous attraction. The lyrics highlight internal conflict, better not touch, you know. And also, you know, maybe given Cooper's history with past struggles with addiction, poison may have been a metaphor for some of that as well.
Makes sense.
Just guessing. What were your thoughts on poison?
It's funny, like, I don't remember this, even though I was, like, watching MTV and stuff. I don't really remember this song, but, you know, listening to it now, it definitely fits in that era.
Sure.
And I think it might kind of stand just a bit above the other stuff at the time. I mean, it's very much on par with the Bon Jovi records of the time, Def Leppard.
For sure.
The Aerosmith was
comeback.
Permanent Vacation and Pump.
Yeah. And Pump.
Yep. Yep. But, yeah, it just, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed this record. You know, I mean, all these songs are like, I want to sing along with. It's, you know,
yeah,
like,
me too.
Like I'm in the crowd, you know, with my fist in the air.
I got to tell you, this was a desperation play. When we're looking at the top 10, I was like, I'm screwed here. What am I going to pick?
Yeah.
And I was thinking it would have to end up being Billy Joel. But then I listened to this and then I listened again. And by the third listen, I'm like, I'm locked in.
It's kind of, it's amazing how neatly the Alice Cooper persona kind of fits with this era as well.
Yeah. Yeah. He was probably like 40, 41 at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, seeing what happened with Aerosmith reigniting their career and then bands like Def Leppard and Bon Jovi and being like, hey, I want to get in on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. Of course, we have to have, you know, your power ballads included in these records. And so this one actually features, this could have been an Aerosmith song as far as I'm concerned. It features little Steven Tyler. It's called Only My Heart Talking. If I heard this in that era, I would have assumed it was an Aerosmith song with maybe, you know, Joe Perry singing.
Yeah. I can't do it with, like, the thing that Steven does.
Yeah, I can't either. This one was released as a single around March, April 1990. Written by Alice Cooper, Bruce Roberts, and Andy Goldmark. Produced by Desmond Child, of course. I guess it hit 89 on the Billboard Hot 100. So, you know, not a big smash or anything. But it's about vulnerability, regret, longing. I held back my true feelings. I never said the words out loud. You know, your standard fare in this world, but repeating only my heart talking a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of has a every rose has its thorn vibe a little bit, but
a little fuller in sound.
Yeah, you know. This one's better, I think.
According to Cooper, he reached out to Tyler because he admired his voice. Mm. They spent roughly 8 hours in the studio working on it,
nice.
Which, you know, for these kind of collabs, that's actually a decent amount of time, especially if they're in the studio together instead of like the record your part and we'll sync it up.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, Desmond Child, I think, had a relationship with all these artists.
Well, he wrote a bunch of songs for Aerosmith and Bon Jovi and like big hits.
Yeah. I didn't realize how important a figure he was in this era. I mean, he's all over so many of the glam rock albums of the late 80s.
Yeah, but the ones of the not on the so much on the like Motley Crue poison side of things, but more on the, you know, Bon Jovi's and you know, the more melodic stuff. So we had, as I mentioned, we had a lot of guest performers, guest writers. Don, did you have a song you wanted to highlight?
Yeah. So one track was actually co-written with Joan Jett, famously of the Runaways and Joan Jett and the Blackhearts.
You can hear it once you know it.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it's called House of Fire.
Like on the surface, it's so corny. All the babies and stuff, but then, like, I really love the image of building your house on the passion, the fire, you know?
Yeah. It's just a very well-executed song. I mean, the guitar work is crunchy and, fun. I don't know. For some reason, it really, yeah, I was just really taken by this record, listening to it this week. Really a pleasant surprise.
No shit, yeah. Man. Like, I didn't have much hope. And I found a record that I missed that at the time that I actually really, really love.
Yeah. And we've felt, I think, compelled to talk about Alice Cooper before, but like we've never gotten around to it. And
well, we've tried at Halloween time and stuff, but it just never quite fit. And this was divine providence. Yeah. A total accident that this happened to the week was that they were that he was at 10 with that single, because if it was the next week and it dropped to 11, we would have been stuck with Milli Vanilli or something. Yeah. So.
One thing I also like about this song, I think it's similar. I think Living on a Prayer does the same thing. Like towards the end of the song, like, you know, they're just doing the chorus over and over. And then all of a sudden they do the chorus, maybe like just a step up, like, you know, just a little higher. I forgot what that, that there's a name for that, which I'm not smart enough
to know. Bon Jovio, I think.
Yeah. So they do that. So it's Bon Jovio.
So, you know, a lot of fun songs, fist pumping anthems and stuff throughout. But then we get into the more sort of sleaze rock territory, you know, the vibes of the 70s, maybe in Kiss and things like that, where we have to have a phallic representation in one of the songs. We close it out with I'm Your Gun. Dress up like a nun. My God. I still like it, though. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Like, moments of like, gee-yah, but...
Yeah. Looks like a guitar in the background. I mean, it's just... Yeah. It's good stuff.
The Winger, Kip Winger backing vocals are pretty effective as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I do roll my eyes at the, you know, with the phallic references and stuff, but yeah, it's still, it's fine.
Well, here's the challenge. Try it with your significant other. Be like, pull my trigger. I get bigger. Then I'm lots of fun. Yeah. See what happens.
I wonder if that ever worked for these guys.
Not outside of the backstage environment, I wouldn't think.
Yeah.
But Kip Winger, who did the backing vocals, had a prior working relationship with Cooper. He played bass on Constrictor in 86 and Raise Your Fist and Yell in 87. And then, of course, started his own band, Winger. But I thought the voice enhanced the layered vocals and added a little something that Alice couldn't do vocally, the kind of screamy stuff, which I think added to the metal, you know, the so metal.
Yeah.
Kind of thing where it makes all the entendre a little more acceptable somehow sonically.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Don, I'm going to dress up like a nun and we will rewind and reflect on Poison. Okay, to kick off my overall vibe, glam, grit, Desmond Childs, and enough snake venom to kill your stereo. Alice Cooper's Trash bites back in 1989. This was, you know, a big deal. After a quiet decade, the album was sleek, arena-ready glam metal reinvention, balancing shock rock and the chart-friendly hooks. Unmistakably Alice, but definitely playful, larger-than-life, and accessible to a certain extent.
Oh, yeah.
Gave him his first platinum album in many, many years, but it's 40 minutes of confident, theatrical, hard rock that I really dug. What's your overall vibe on this one?
Well, I'll give you my headline. With a little help, Cooper gives us a dose of bad medicine, or poison, if you will. Because there's a couple of songs that remind me of bad medicine.
Well, Desmond Childs was in on that song, too. So
yeah. So, yeah, I mean, as you said, it's got that hard rock edge with pop sensibility. And, you know, you're throwing in the late 80s glossy synths, you know, to make it just a little more palatable. And you still have elements of Cooper's theatrical shock value. So, yeah, it's really just a perfect marriage, you know, that I wouldn't have expected.
Yeah, I think we both were pleasantly surprised here. Killer to filler. I mean, I think every track is good. Like, there's not one I want to skip over. Some that also stood out to me, Bed of Nails. That was track 6.
That's the Diane Warren one, I think. It was co-written by Diane Warren, who's written a lot of things.
But it works really well. The hammer, the bed of nails, like, and the bed of nails. It just has that Def Leppard. Yeah.
Everything has a huge chorus on. Like that.
Hell Is Living Without You. That one was co-written by John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora. Mm-hmm. Lots of harmonies, emotive vocals. What did you think about that one? I thought it was a standout.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good one. I like the harmonies. I think the Trash, the title track, that one has that has John Bon Jovi and Aerosmith in it too, I think.
Yeah, and that's a great one. Mm-hmm. I thought the Trash was very strong. I was kind of hoping it'd be a New York Dolls cover.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah, it would have worked. Spark in the Dark I thought was awesome as well. Just so catchy. And that idea of, you know, again, innuendo instead of let's make out or whatever. Let's find that spark in the dark.
Yeah,
you know?
I think that one had me really feeling Def Leppard-y.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for fillers, I mean, like I'm Your Gun probably would fall into that category for me.
We'd be okay if it wasn't there probably.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy it. With that, for what it is. What about This Maniac's in Love with You? At first, just from the title, I'm like, eh. But yeah. It's campy enough that I found a way to enjoy it.
Yeah. It kind of plays with his, you know, persona, I think, is maybe some sort of maniac. So, yeah, it worked. And then maybe it was sort of obligatory to have a song like that where it is Alice Cooper.
I'm crazy. Yeah. Baby. Lots of babies on this one. Production wise, Desmond Child produced it with precision. Those layered vocals, those choruses are polished up real nice. Tight guitar mix. The guest appearances do add some texture. Lots of gang vocals, which was so of the time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Type of things, you know.
Sometimes, like, having a lot of guests, you know, makes me roll my eyes or something, or it feels like it's a crutch. But, I mean, it just really works on this album. And, I mean, maybe it wouldn't have worked if he didn't have all those guests.
Right. Well, I think it's also kind of, in this case, like, hey, people have been ignoring me a little bit for a while. Listen to this and look who my friends are.
Yeah. And then I think everybody else is like, hey, let's help Alice have a hit record.
Of course, because they probably were influenced by him to some degree.
Yeah.
Replay value, for me, very high.
Yes.
First half is almost flawless, full of singles, full of like songs you want to return to. The fillers are enjoyable too. But yeah, all 40 minutes, no fatigue, hallmark of late 80s production excellence.
Yeah, I think this might be a good like conversational piece to, you know, like, oh, you know, have you heard this Alice Cooper album, you know, when he went glam, you know?
Right.
Because it's not, you know, I mean, people are thinking of, you know, 18 and School's Out and all those. And you know, this is Alice Cooper in a different era. But these songs were just as big and probably sold. I mean, this album probably sold as well as those 70s albums.
Yeah, for sure. And he got to appear in Wayne's World, which I, you know, maybe this was part of that. Yeah, so legacy-wise, it reestablished Alice Cooper as a relevant arena rock act, demonstrated he could adapt to a contemporary sound without losing his identity, and it works really well.
Yeah, I think it, I mean, it certainly helped Alice Cooper's legacy. I think having this hit album in this era probably kept him in our consciousness. And, you know, so it, you know, sort of fills him out as a legacy artist, I think.
Mm-hmm. So Trash kicks Alice Cooper's comeback tour of the late 80s and early 90s into full gear, carefully produced, hook heavy, and darkly beautiful. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Okay. Well, we immersed ourselves in 1989. Did you find anything else to dig this week? Any cassettes in your leather jacket, your bomber jacket, we used to call them, I think? I had a suede one, actually, I think.
My sister had a bomber jacket. It was brown. It had the, like, map on the inside liner from, like, Wilson's leather place.
Oh, yeah.
Leather store in the mall. I did not have a leather jacket. I was too cool. I found some interesting things. Actually, this came out a couple weeks ago. I guess it's AVTTPTTN or Avett Patton. I'm not sure. But that's the name of the collective as well as the album. A collaboration between the Avett brothers, Scott and Seth Avett, known for their heartfelt Americana and folk rock, and Mike Patton, the genre-defying frontman of Faith No More, Mr. Bungle, and many, many, many other experimental projects. It's a 9-track self-titled debut, blending Appalachian folk warmth with art rock intensity. Of course. What else? produced by Patton and Scott Abbott, Dana Nielsen. It features soaring three-part harmonies, scuzzy reinterpretations of traditional folk, and fuzz rock textures on songs like what we're going to listen to now, Heaven's Breath. Yeah, so it's certainly an interesting mix. I have typically found, I don't have a problem with the Abbott Brothers, but I've usually found their albums to not be very exciting. And this has some new textures that make it more, for my listening taste, more something I'd want to hear.
Yeah, I spent some time with this yesterday, the whole album, and I like it. I think it could find its way on one of my year-end lists.
Really?
I like that you pretended to be excited by that
album. I am excited. I'll be tweeting all about that later on today. So I figured, why not stick in the pocket? You know, we got a little Patton. Gets me waxing nostalgic about Faith No More and The Real Thing. So I try and pick something that I have in my album collection. In this case, it's a CD. I'm sure it's available on vinyl, but probably outside of my price range. But Faith No More, American rock band known for their genre-bending blend of metal, funk, hip-hop, and alternative. Mike Patton joined as lead vocalist in 1988, kind of transforming their sound, and The Real Thing came out in 89. And we had a little mainstream success with this song, Epic. Yeah, so definitely, if you haven't listened to that whole album ever or in a while, go back. There's some interesting shit going on there.
Yeah, I remember listening to this for the show. Loved it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the copy of this I have, I shamefully did trade away my original back when I was short on cash and looking to get other CDs. But I picked up off of Amazon, it's this triple collection. It's from 2012 from Europe, apparently. But it's got The Real Thing, Angel Dust, and King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime. Three of their albums at their peak with Patton. So it's a pretty cool little collection. They come in separate sleeves, so each album has its own cover and everything. So what about you, Don? What you digging on?
Well, I just discovered that De La Soul has a new album, kind of a show favorite.
Yeah, I've been waiting for it. But I missed it somehow. Yeah,
well, it just came out like this week, I think.
Okay.
So the album's called Cabin in the Sky. And of course, it's their first effort. Yeah, since the loss of Trugoy, who passed away in 2023.
For those that don't know, he loved yogurt. And that's why he has the name Trugoy, because it's yogurt backwards.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. Did we talk about that before?
Probably.
We must have. Although I do think they do have some tracks of Trugoy before he passed, which make their way onto the album. But here's a track called The Package.
LI's finest craftmatic. This ain't the sit down pillow top package. Keep the tenor
boy beyond summertime.
Yeah. Since I'm still, you know, kind of learning hip hop, well, we're just now getting to the point where you have sort of artists that are older.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, so is listening to De La Soul the same as listening to a new Sting record? You know, like it's kind of, you know, because I don't know, hip hop always had so much energy, you know, and so then to have, you know, somebody that's in their 50s rapping feels weird, but.
Wow, that's ageist.
I guess it is. Okay. And another group I recently discovered, some algorithm is suggesting a lot of like indie folk stuff. So there is a band from Ireland called Kingfisher. This is their debut album, although they've been around for a while, releasing mostly live stuff. The album's called Halcyon. Just kind of, you know, blends sort of your atmospheric folk, indie pop hooks. And it definitely has like an Ireland vibe. Here's a song called Diamonds and Roses.
Yeah, I feel like the Abbott Brothers fan base would dig this.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about the time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of Alice Cooper. It's not about dressing like a nun this time. So we got that going for us. If you're going to try to write a hit single, don't be clever. Be obvious. Get to the chorus. Get to the hook. Get to the meat right away.
I bet Casey Kasem would agree.
I'm sure he would. So we've been honoring Casey Kasem over the last few weeks, and you know, he passed away in 2014, and here we are closing in on the end of 2025, and it got us thinking about those that we've lost in the music industry this year. So we're going to honor them and pick a couple of albums from artists that passed away in 2025 and kind of start looking back, as we often do this time of year. Sound good, Don?
Yes.
As always, great interplay and repartee. You're legendary in the business.
Yeah. I remember at some point this year being like, wow, we've lost a lot of good ones. Yeah. So this will be good.
Yep. We'll honor the departed.
I'm not laughing at the dead people, but
the accent.
Well, what's your favorite record from somebody who we lost in 2025? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 316 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you, as always, for joining us here on the ANP.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. We'll catch you next time. We'll make sure to wear black.
Oh, the world's a candy store. He's been trick-or-treating. When it comes to true love, go with him. There's no one home. He's a cold-hearted snake.
No, I don't know who I sound like. It's not Robert Smith.
It sounds like Robert Smith while he's spending time in the water closet. That's a bathroom for the uninitiated.
I tried.
All right, we'll see you next time.